What's up, guys? You're listening to the most captivating podcast in iTunes. That's right, the Elite Man Podcast, where we turn average men into elite men every day. We record episodes and interview the very best experts from around the world and cover topics relating to health, success, mindset, business, and even social issues. And each week, we give you some of the best advice and information on the planet. Subscribe now if you haven't already and enjoy the show. And oh yeah, if you really enjoy it, leave us a review. Your elite life begins now. On today's episode, episode number 367, entitled How to Understand the Secret Power of the Universe and Real-Life Magical Phenomena, I chat with Dr. Dean Radin. Dr. Dean Radin is a chief scientist at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, associate distinguished professor at the California Institute of Integral Studies, and the author of many best-selling books, including his newest one, Real Magic, Ancient Wisdom, Modern Science, and a Guide to the Secret Power of the Universe. In today's episode, Dean talks about his work studying and providing evidence for what many of us have come to know as supernatural or paranormal phenomena. He provides many fascinating first-hand accounts of the evidence he's come across and what the science reveals about these uncommon experiences. If you're wondering what magic looks like in real life and in the universe, check out this episode now. You're going to love it. All right, guys, we're live. It's Justin Stenstrom from Elite Man Magazine, and my guest today is Dean Radin, the chief scientist at the Institute of Noetic Sciences and the author of a number of books. His most recent is Real Magic, Ancient Wisdom, Modern Science, and a Guide to the Secret Power of the Universe. Dean, thanks so much for coming on the show today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, I mentioned a moment ago, I stumbled across your work a few months back and just kind of fell in love with somebody. I forget who it was, but I was reading some type of mystical author or maybe watching a YouTube video of some supernatural influencer out there. And they mentioned your name as someone who, it might even have been like Joe Dispenza, one of those guys, but they mentioned your name as someone who has proof of like a lot of supernatural, paranormal type of things. Not just hearsay, anecdotes, stories, this and that, but someone who's studied this and researched this for decades and actually can prove scientifically that a lot of these things are actually, in fact, true. There's a whole gambit of things that I want to talk about today and some of the research that you've done. But when I talk about like paranormal, supernatural, it really does encompass a lot of different topics. And I know that you've studied a lot of these different things. So it's quite fascinating to have somebody merge the two fields of science and then supernatural, almost super science that we can't explain yet, and actually bring it so that people, lay people, or just people that are not really familiar with the paranormal community can understand it better, or at least understand it in their own way. Can you just talk about, though, for a moment, how you got into this research? I'm guessing it was 3-4 decades ago.
Yeah, about 4 decades. Let me say a few words first. As a scientist, science is not about proof. Right? All we can do is provide evidence and explanations that we can test. But the proof, in a sense, is in the pudding, and that you find proof in alcohol, and you find proof in logic, and proof in mathematics, but not in science. We're all about evidence. The other things are words like paranormal and supernatural. One of my books is called Supernormal, meaning normal, but just bigger. But paranormal is not a very useful word because it includes such a wide range of phenomena that are not well explained yet. Everything from Bigfoot to astrology to UFOs and everything else under the sun. And most of that is actually not either not studied by science at all or very difficult to study. So things that are spontaneous, for example, like almost everything we know about UFOs are spontaneous, which is perfectly valid as a phenomenon, but it's very difficult then to test under scientific rules. And likewise, the word supernatural is not very useful because it suggests that it's above the natural world and science can't test anything that's outside the natural world. So I use the word supernormal sometimes in the same sense that we'd look at our favorite sports figure who's doing something that most people can't do. They get a lot of money for that. So super talent and super normal, I would put into the same category. But words like paranormal and supernatural, I tend to avoid because it's not something that a scientist can actually study.
Okay.
So how did I get involved with all this? Well, I probably read one too many science fiction books and or the equivalent of Harry Potter when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Well, when I was a kid, there was no Harry Potter, but there's a lot of books like that have always been around. And like a lot of kids, I always wondered, certainly it would be fun to have such powers that are described, but I was also quite skeptical about these things because I didn't have these experiences. So I wondered, well, is any of that even possible to be true? So I enjoyed the stories. I still do. I watch as much movies and TV shows now as I always did. The difference is that as a teenager, I discovered that there was a scientific discipline that had been looking at these kinds of phenomena since the late 1800s. And it's the formal name is parapsychology, which I don't like that term either, because again, the word para means not quite in the vernacular. And ultimately, it's a lot like the discipline of psychology, that what we're studying are people's experiences. And it's a perfectly valid thing to study from a scientific perspective, because we all have such experiences. But if somebody describes something like they had a dream that was very unusual and they woke up and the thing came true, so how do you explain that? Well, maybe it was a coincidence. Maybe you saw something that reminded you of something. Maybe you misremembered it. Maybe. Lots of possibilities. But if you want to find out if something like that is true in principle, you need to go into the laboratory and you need to look at those kinds of phenomena under controlled conditions. So I read about this when I was like 12 or 13 years old, that people have been doing these kinds of studies. And I thought, okay, this is something you can get your teeth into, because you can now test under conditions that exclude coincidence and excludes all of the other human biases and frailties, and find out whether something like that is true, even in principle. So as a teenager, I started dabbling in this sort of stuff, and I got more and more interested in it because I was able to do experiments that showed that things like precognition and clairvoyance and so on, those actually can be seen in the laboratory, and they don't conform to mundane explanations, suggesting that they're really real. Well, now suddenly all the entertainment stories become much more interesting. Now, of course, entertainment is an elaboration of the real world, but nevertheless, it says that these stories didn't just fall out of the sky. They are reflections of things that actually do happen to people. So that's how I got into it. And the more I got into it, the more interesting it became. So I basically spent almost my entire career doing this kind of research.
Okay. And parapsychology, is that what you actually, like, is there, I mean, I have no idea, this might be a foolish question, but is there college courses for that? Did you go to school for that specifically, or did you go to school for something else and transition into that field, but it's not technically something that you can get at university?
You can study this in a few universities in the UK. Including Scotland. But as a formal academic discipline, the answer is no. All of my academic background, I have a bachelor's and master's in electrical engineering, and my doctorate's in psychology, all from traditional universities. So you can take courses, like occasional courses, even occasional classes in a university setting, but there's no career track in this domain, because it's considered to be so controversial from a scientific perspective that anybody who gets involved in it has to basically learn it by themselves, which is what I did.
Why do you think it is that the universities and academics and most scientists, like you said, you don't like the term supernatural or even parapsychology? Why is there such a stigma against this type of research? And why is it that you mentioned science is evidence? It's not proof, it's finding the evidence. And from your research and from what I've learned, just, you know, from watching some of the interviews and, you know, things that you've put out there, there's a ton of research out there. There's a ton of evidence out there to support a lot of these things we're going to talk about today. Why is it that the mainstream scientists and academics don't like covering this when there's so much out there?
One of the reasons is that we don't yet have adequate scientific explanations as to why these effects should be real. Now, that's beginning to change, but this is especially true for non-physicists, and even more so in psychology, that there's been an assumption for a long time that if something doesn't seem to be compatible with the, quote, laws of physics, then it cannot be true. It must be impossible. Unfortunately, or people who are not involved in physics probably haven't tracked the reality that physics has changed. It is like any scientific discipline, they're always changing. So quantum mechanics presents a picture of reality which actually is compatible with psychic phenomena. Even there's puzzles, like we don't know exactly how to connect the quantum picture of reality with these kinds of experiences. But for someone to say that these are impossible, these things are impossible because it doesn't fit what we know about physical reality, they don't know what they're talking about. But nevertheless, it is quite true that in the academic world, the disciplines tend to be siloed in the sense that if you're a psychologist, you study a very thin slice with very deep silos, but the silos tend not to talk to each other. I've been in the academic world, and you see this firsthand. There's a kind of aspiration in the academic world to have complete freedom to study anything that you want. But that's a myth. That never happens. And it's because, well, we don't normally think of it in this way, but academia is, it's all based on ideology. It's based on ideas. I mean, you make your whole career based on ideas, whether it's experimental or theoretical, it's still ideas. If someone comes to you and says, you know, some of your ideas are probably not right, that's not simply the beginning of a debate. That feels like a personal attack because you identify, we all do, I do this too, we identify with our ideas. So if somebody says, you're stupid because you believe this, well, how are you going to respond? You respond emotionally. So the aspirations in the academic world are rational, but we're people, you know, we can be rational occasionally, but not if you feel that you're being attacked. So a lot of it and a lot of the taboo then manifests in a very strange way in the academic world, where privately academics will have the same kind of experiences that everyone else has, and they'll talk about it privately after five or six beers, but they won't talk about it from a professional sense because they all learn very quickly that you just don't talk about this stuff. So, and there are many other taboos like this that people don't talk about. So I'll just give one example. Years ago, I was at the University of Nevada. In Nevada, there are places where prostitution is legal. Well, it's not officially legal in Las Vegas, but of course it's virtually legal. So one of my colleagues at the university there was interested in doing a sociological study of what it's like to be a prostitute. What is the sociology of that like in Las Vegas? She wasn't allowed to do that. Even though it's like in your face, practically, yeah. You're not allowed to do that because it would, at the time, it was presenting a picture of Las Vegas that the city fathers were trying to make it more like a family-friendly place, which was ridiculous, but nevertheless, that's what they were trying to do.
Yeah.
And so she was not allowed to do that study. And so it's one example of many like that, where if you are pushing against the status quo, whatever that may be, you don't have freedom to study what you want to study.
Yeah, that's sad. Yeah, there's a lot of things like that. And, you know, there's so many brilliant minds out there too in the world that if they just were allowed to do some of this stuff, I think we'd be a lot further than we are because they're hindered. And they might, you know, look at some videos on YouTube or check out some of your stuff here and there, you know, in their private homes. But when it comes to the lab, when it comes to conversing with their colleagues and talking about this stuff, I don't think they're really allowed to, which is pretty sad.
Yeah. Yep. That's the human condition. We are social creatures. We have to be.
Yeah.
And so we follow certain social rules.
Yeah. What about the things that they'll mention to you? Like, what are some of the things, like you said, after a few drinks, somebody will bring up because they're feeling a little more, you know, comfortable with talking to you and sharing some of these things that they wouldn't even tell their wives in some cases, or their family members? What are some of the common ones that, like, I guess, psychic experiences or super normal experiences, as you like to put it? What are some of the common ones that they typically bring up?
I would say that the most common are precognitive experiences, usually in dreams, but sometimes in the waking state. And typically the way it would manifest is if you remember your dreams, after a while, you begin to recognize that some of them have an unusual quality to them. They're more vivid, they're more realistic or something. And so you wake up in the morning and it's still sort of rattling around in your head. And it's a little unusual. So you're thinking, well, what was that about? And then sometime during that day, whatever that was unfolds. And so, yeah, and of course you remember it. It's kind of shocking that this happens. Some people, this happens often enough that they wonder, am I going crazy? My memory's not working right. You know, this is not a deja vu. This is like unfolding of something I already experienced. So I know major scientists who've talked to me about this and directors of centers at the academic centers. They're sort of desperate to talk to somebody about it because it's so shocking to them. And oftentimes, if they're academics, they have notebooks and pictures and things like documenting their own experience that they want to share. And they know that I'm not going to make fun of them because this is the sort of thing that I study. And I do find it quite interesting, but they generally haven't told anyone, including their spouse, because they're a little afraid of it, or at least they're afraid of what people will think about it.
When you say precognition, is that an umbrella for a group of similar phenomena, or is it really just like the thing that you mentioned specifically, where you have a dream and then a few hours later, something like that same thing happens in real life? Is it specifically that, or is it kind of an umbrella of a few different things?
Well, it's a spectrum of different kinds of experiences. Most occur in dreams. And this is actually across the board. The most common reported spontaneous psychic phenomenon is a precognitive dream. But it also manifests in other ways. So here's a different story. So I had a friend once who liked to go hunting, and he had lots of guns. And so he's cleaning some pistols. And one of the pistols is a double-action revolver with six chambers. So he keeps five bullets in it with the hammer over the empty chamber for safety. So he takes all the bullets out, and now he's cleaning the gun. He's putting the bullets back in, 1, 2, 3, 4, and he held the fifth bullet. He said he got a really creepy feeling about that bullet, so he left it out. So the hammer's over the fifth empty chamber, but now the one next to it's empty as well. So they go hunting. They come back after a day hunting, and they start doing what you should not do if there's a lot of guns around. They start drinking. So two of the fellows there were drinking and got into an argument. One grabs my friend's gun, points it point blank at the other person, and is squeezing the trigger. Wow. So that, as you know, in a double action revolver, the hammer goes back, the cylinder turns, and then it's going to hit. So he's watching this with horror, and he steps in between the two to stop this. It was too late. The hammer had already gone back, and it went click into the chamber that he took the bullet out of. And he realized at that moment that his feeling, his bad feeling about this, was essentially a signal, or it could be thought of as a signal from the future. In this case, it was 2 weeks in the future. There was something wrong about this thing. So the joke he makes about it now is that everybody has a bullet with their name on it, and he knows where that bullet is in his case because he put it in the safety deposit box. So he has that bullet. So this is an example. It's an example of an experience. That one's pretty dramatic, but a lot of people have had a similar experience where they're driving along to work a certain way, and they've done this 1,000 times, and they're approaching a green light. Normally, they would start speeding up a little bit to make sure they make the light, but today they get a bad feeling. And so they slow down and they keep slowing down. And the cars behind them are wondering, what's wrong with this person? We have a green light, but you keep slowing down. So you slow down to the point you're coming almost at a crawl at the intersection, and suddenly a truck goes through the red light crossways and would have hit you if you had continued going. So people report this as a presentiment, right? They didn't know what was going to happen. It's not precognizing, it's pre-feeling, pre-sentiment. So we turned that, and also my friend with the gun, we turned that into a laboratory test to see if whether unconsciously you can essentially feel what is about to happen. Not consciously, but your body responds to it in some way. And that turns out, they call it a presentiment experiment. It's not that difficult to do in the laboratory. And the results have now been replicated in about 48 studies. I forget exactly how many, but something like 10 laboratories around the world. And it shows that somewhere between about 1 and 10 seconds before a shocking event takes place, everything from seeing a very emotional picture to literally an electrical shock, that your body begins to gear up for that, even under conditions where nobody knows in advance whether you're going to get a shock or you're going to get no shock, or he's going to see an emotional picture or a calm picture. So it's an easy experiment to run in the laboratory if you have the right equipment, and it works.
As I mentioned last week, guys, we will be launching a new podcast, an entirely separate podcast called the American Freedom Tribe Podcast. This is going to be tackling social issues, political issues, controversial issues, topics that we try to stay away from on the Elite Man Podcast, because at the Elite Man Podcast, we have historically and going forward, we'll be focusing entirely on personal development, self-help, that stuff that you guys love, and kind of staying away from more of the controversial topics, the ones that are really polarizing and can be divisive in some ways. So if you want to hear more of that content, which some of you love, and I guess, of course, some of you don't really love, which is perfectly okay. But if you want to hear more of the controversial and perhaps juicier topics, and perhaps ones that may piss off a lot of people, but you may agree with as well, social issues, political issues, controversial issues, etc., you're definitely going to want to check out the American Freedom Tribe podcast coming out in just a couple short weeks. So stay tuned for more information. Get on the Elite Man newsletter, elitemanmagazine.com/newsletter, to know instantly when we drop the new podcast and when we hit the ground running, because we've already recorded a few of them. So when we actually release the new podcast, there's going to be several out, and you're going to want to catch up immediately on all that's going on. I think personally that 70 to 80% of the Elite Man podcast is going to love these topics and some of the issues that we cover here. But just for the sake of the rest of the audience of the Elite Man podcast, I wanted to create an entirely separate podcast and focus more on the issues and the topics that we cover on the Elite Man podcast strictly for this, and all the other ones put on the new podcast coming up. So needless to say, I am incredibly excited for the new podcast. I want you guys to check it out and hopefully subscribe to the channel on iTunes, Spotify, all the other platforms as well that we launch it on. It's going to be on Rumble as well, and bits and pieces of it will be on YouTube for the video portions. So AmericanFreedomTribe.com is the place that you'll be able to find all this information as well. You can even sign up for the newsletter there too. And you can check out some gear in the meantime. We have incredible hats, we have t-shirts, we have sweatshirts, hoodies, all that stuff on AmericanFreedomTribe.com. So check it out right now, AmericanFreedomTribe.com, and stay tuned for the American Freedom Tribe podcast coming out very soon. All right, so it's super easy to run this in a lab. I'm guessing that you have some kind of like shocker or something, and then you're testing out their, what, brain signals, EEG type of technology, and seeing like what's going on before it happens, and you can actually trace that in real time.
Yeah.
Something like that.
You do the analyses afterwards, but this has been done using skin conductance, sometimes called galvanic skin conductance. It's basically the same sort of thing that you would find in a polygraph system. So we're measuring breathing, skin conductance, pupil dilation, EEG, heart rate, all of those kinds of things. It's measuring different aspects of the nervous system, most of which is unconscious. But nevertheless, you can see it. You see that the signal is different before an emotional event than it is before a calm event.
Okay. And 48 different studies have proven this, or at least you don't like the word proof. So at least I've shown the evidence.
Have demonstrated the effect beyond chance levels.
Yeah. I got to get used to that. And so in your research, and you know, by the way, like I want to go back to what you said a moment ago, but I want to stick on this first. So in your research, all of this stuff that you're doing, which is showing the evidence, how do you explain that? If you're just talking to like to a friend, if you go on an interview, if you're asked this question of what do you personally think is going on after studying all of this stuff as you know, another human being who experiences the world and experiences life and these different incredible things that are going on all the time, how do you explain what's happening in these 48 studies? What is that that's making the human body pre-sentiment, pre-feel exactly what's going to happen before it happens?
Yeah, that's the sticking part. If I had a really good explanation, then this wouldn't be considered controversial. I have a proposal.
Yeah.
To think what I think is going on. There's several ways to get into how you describe what's going on here. As I discuss in my book, Real Magic, that ultimately it comes down to how you think the world works in general. This becomes a question of philosophy. And for philosophy, for most people, it turns out to be a cure for insomnia. If you're not used to thinking in philosophical terms, it will make you fall asleep almost instantaneously. And I'm no different than that. I'm not a philosopher, but I've been basically pulled kicking and screaming to realize that science, like anything else, rests on a whole set of assumptions. The nice thing about science is it's continually evolving, and we discover that some of the assumptions that we used to have are actually false. That makes it different than religion, where in religion you're not allowed to question the assumptions. In science, you're forced to. So there are different philosophies about the nature of reality. In science, we use one called materialism. It assumes that everything is ultimately made out of matter and energy. Everything, including consciousness, including your own set of experiences, the thing that you call me inside yourself, that is assumed to come out of brain activity. So you see a lot of books with titles like You Are Your Brain. And this is sort of common knowledge among educated people now, except that there's a fair amount of evidence that may not be true. And more and more evidence as time goes on. And even in the academic world now, scientists and philosophers are questioning, is consciousness really being constructed by the brain, or is it somehow just part of the fabric of reality? It's like energy is simply there, and charges and electrons are there. We don't know how to explain it, but it's there. Well, maybe consciousness is part of the fabric of reality too. So from one perspective then, as I, again, describe in my book, Real Magic, which is about the esoteric worldview, that worldview, a philosopher would say, is idealism. That's the name of the concept that consciousness is not only a real thing that is different than matter and energy, it's the thing that gives rise to matter and energy. And the way that this is often described is, well, tell me something that you know. It could be anything. Say, well, I read this in a book and it's saying that this, and you know, so I believe it because people in authority have shown that it exists. Okay. I know that Zoom is real because we're using it at the moment and it seems to be working. Well, how do I know that? I can only know that because that's what my experience says, right? You only can know anything about the world through your personal experience. Well, your personal experience is the only thing that you actually will ever know for sure. That means that everything else, including everything that we know in science, everything we know about the external world is an inference based on our personal experience. That's essentially what idealism is telling us, that from this perspective, the only thing you could actually ever know for sure is your own experience. So maybe the physical world emerges somehow out of not your experience necessarily, but some sort of grand awareness that permeates everything. So this is what mystics have been telling us throughout history, that ultimately all there is awareness. So that's one possibility. This, if you take that perspective and say, well, then what's materialism? Well, materialism becomes a special case of the way of viewing reality, in exactly the same way that classical physics is a special case of a more broader understanding of physics, which is encompassed by quantum mechanics and by relativity, right? It's all physics, except that those are a more comprehensive way of understanding in a larger sense for relativity and in a smaller sense from quantum mechanics. So maybe that's a way of seeing this. And of course, the joy of it is that if idealism is a proper way of understanding reality, then suddenly magical practices and psychic phenomena and mystical experience are all easy to understand. So the reason why you can perceive something at a far distance, including through time, is because that's your experience. Your experience comes before physics. It's creating physics. So it means it's not bound by space and time. So that's the very short answer. Another approach, though, that you can take is, well, maybe materialism is correct, except that our notion of what we mean by material now is very different and is changing all the time. 100 years ago, material was hard stuff like a rock. That's it. That's the end of the story. It does certain things, and you can figure out through Newtonian mechanics how to get to the moon and back, just purely based on classical physics. Well, the modern world runs on quantum mechanics mostly, some relativistic ideas too. But of course, the peculiar thing about quantum mechanics is it says that at a very deep level of physical reality, there is no matter as such. There are relationships, and the relationships transcend the usual everyday boundaries of space and time. So we're talking about phenomena like non-local effects, like quantum entanglement and so on. These are called weird because it doesn't seem to match our experience of the everyday world, but we know the Nobel Prize was awarded this year to the people who experimentally showed that entanglement is a real thing. So things are connected through space and time. Well, okay, so if somebody has a precognitive experience, they're perceiving through time. Is that possible? Well, yeah, entanglement works just as well through time as it does through space. And we know that that's real. So why is it strange that our experience would sometimes work through time as well? The reason why that's been resisted, but is changing now, is because it was thought, well, let's say that your awareness does emerge out of brain activity. Well, the brain's not operating as a quantum computer. So it wouldn't, it's not even possible for the brain to do that. So you can't have an experience that's transcending space or time. Well, now people are beginning to think that there are aspects of the brain that do operate as a quantum computer. Why? Because there are elements within the brain, just like any other physical system, that are ultimately quantum. Like what's going on at the level of a synapse or ions in the brain, that's at the quantum scale. That is operating at a level where things like entanglement can exist. There are counter arguments that a physicist will offer, but they're beginning to go away. And the reason is that it's been found that quantum effects in biology are not simply possible, but are necessary for living systems to operate in the way that they do. So this is the relatively new discipline of quantum biology. So that's a materialistic way of thinking of how these things can be real. That the brain actually aspects of our experience are non-local. They're not limited to inside your head. They extend out through space and time. I've been predicting for about 20 years already that eventually we will find that there are aspects of the brain that are operating in a quantum fashion. And some grad student 10 or 20 years from now will say, oh, well, if that's really true, then there should be non-local forms of experience. And they'll do an experiment and it'll work. And that will be, in today's terms, that will be a psychic effect. But in that future time, they'll have some other name for it. And then if we're really lucky, they'll look back in the literature and say, oh, people have been doing experiments in this for over 100 years. And they didn't know what they were dealing with because they didn't have a good explanation. But today we do. And here it is. Yeah. So I'm pretty sure that's going to happen. Something like that's going to happen.
It sounds like it. And they'll probably give the guy a Nobel Prize and look back and say, Dean Radin's work was sitting there for 40 years, man.
I appreciate that. But I'm standing on the shoulders of people who are doing this for 100 years. The only difference is that I'm writing books about it. So I may be associated with this type of research, but there's always been a lot of other scientists who have been interested in this stuff.
Yeah. And I think the other difference too is that we're living in such a time where you can get that word out much more easily. Whereas these guys 100 years ago probably couldn't really get beyond the town or city that they were living in. You go on a podcast, you can be global within a few hours. And I think your message has really resonated too with that, with getting that message out.
Yeah, that's probably some of it. Yeah.
So I want to jump back to what you mentioned before real quick, which was, I don't know what this is, but I'll just ask you because you probably have a better idea of what to call it. But I think it might be a precognition type of thing. But here's something that I get all the time, not all the time, but regularly enough, which is, I won't think of somebody in particular, like, someone I haven't seen in like 10 years, a coworker, someone I went to high school with 15 years ago, somebody, a friend that I haven't even, hasn't crossed my mind in just a long period of time, 4, 5, 10 years, 12 years, whatever it is. And then randomly, that person will jump into my consciousness and I'll think about them for some type of reason. And then I'll think about them for a minute. And then within like 24 hours, I'll come across that person or they'll message me or something to that effect where I'll make contact with this person that I haven't thought of in, a number of years or whatever it may be. But this happens probably every couple months, I would say. And it's the strangest thing. And I've been having this for probably, a dozen years. Is that precognition?
It might be, except that it has gained a name, at least within the modern times, of telephone telepathy.
Yeah,
because you think about them and then they call you and say, what in the world did that happen? So in earlier times, it was called crisis telepathy before there were telephones, because someone would have a sense about something and immediately get a sense, this person's in danger. This person, something happened. In fact, yet another story, the origins of modern neuroscience happened as a result of one of those experiences. Wow. So this is part of the history of neuroscience that people don't remember anymore. So there's this German scientist named Hans Berger, and this is in the mid-1800s, maybe later than that, sometime, 100 years ago. So this was a time when he was in the army and they weren't fighting a war for once, but they were doing exercises. And so he was riding a horse. The horse reared suddenly, got thrown off the horse in front of a cannon battery. So there are a bunch of horses pulling a cannon. And once that thing gets going, there's a lot of inertia. He can't stop. So he's thrown off in front of this thing and he's sure he's going to get run over by the horses and the carriage and get killed. Fortunately, he escapes at the last second. At that moment, his sister, who was something like 80 miles away, gets this horrible feeling that her brother is in serious trouble and does the only thing she could, which at the time was send a telegram to him. So the only telegram he ever got from his sister saying, "Are you okay? I get this really bad feeling." So that experience, he immediately said that somehow she knew that he was in trouble, and he spent the rest of his life trying to discover what he called the psychic energy that must have gone between her and him. And so in the process, he was convinced that it has something to do with the brain and some sort of energy. So he developed the EEG to look for this psychic energy in the brain.
No kidding.
Yeah. So this kind of phenomenon has been around a very long time. It's usually called telepathy because it looks like mind-to-mind connections. But one thing that's been discovered over many such studies is that there's very little difference between telepathy, precognition, clairvoyance. All of these different phenomena that involve perception are probably the same thing. Like it's the same underlying phenomenon. It's something about connectedness at a distance, but it manifests in different ways. We give it names that match our experience. So if it's mind to mind, we call it something. If it's mind to an object or mind to some future event, it seems different, but we're pretty sure that it's actually the same thing. Same underlying connection at a distance.
Yeah. I was thinking too that it might have something to do with the law of attraction. And I know you can explain the law of attraction too, because I've heard you talk about it a little bit in the past. But because a couple of these people were actually people, like one of them was actually an ex-girlfriend that I wanted to reconnect with. And then I thought of her and I was like, And then the next day she called me and, you know, it was like one of those things. So I was like, maybe I attracted that that event to happen because I wanted to reconnect with this girl, and then whatever, she popped in my head. So I was thinking that maybe it had something to do with the law of attraction as well. Like you attract whatever you, whatever you can consciously focus on and kind of create that reality. But, you know, I don't know exactly what it is or how to explain it, but that also seems related to it.
Yeah. So deconstruct what is meant by attraction. What underneath that means there is an intention. You have a desire, a will, an intention. So that's a different class of phenomena that is probably, again, related to all of these effects. This one is as sometimes labeled a psychokinetic effect. In popular terms is telekinetic. I don't like that one either. But so psychokinetic, something like that. Or it's simply mind-matter interaction. So interestingly, that's the second weirdness associated with quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics is non-local. There's entanglements throughout everywhere. But there's also an observer effect. So the observer effect in quantum mechanics suggests that simply paying attention to something will change that thing's behavior. And so maybe there's something like that going on here, that you can non-locally, meaning at a distance in space or time, your intention can change the behavior of something. So if you want to demonstrate levitation, it's really difficult because you're now interacting with something like a heavy brick or something. And in principle, you might be able to influence it a little bit, but the brick has an enormous amount of inertia in it. It does not want to move. Whereas if you're trying to influence another person, we're highly variable. A lot of, you can think of what's going on inside of us as a lot of it is probabilistic noise. Just think about all the stuff going on inside your brain all the time. There's a lot of room there that if you're able to poke something just a little bit at the right time in the right place in your body, you might actually be able to cause a behavioral effect that's different than if you didn't do that. And so there have been a lot of experiments, actually, the experiment of the feeling of being stared at. So this is something commonly reported. Well, it's been done in the laboratory, and we know that if you separate people and just isolate one so they don't know when they're being looked at, typically over a one-way video link. In the older days, it was through a mirror that you could see through one side, but you can't see the other side, and there are lots of other techniques. And in that experiment, typically you would measure, again, physiologically, what is happening to the person being stared at when they don't know it. They become aroused. They become activated. So it sometimes will reach conscious awareness. That's why we know that this thing is the real thing. But even if it doesn't reach conscious awareness, your body still reflects it. You become agitated as a result. So what is that? Is that a matter of one person's intention, intently staring at the other one and sort of mentally shaking them? Well, that's one way of thinking of it. In that case, it would be like a telepathic connection, but it might be something that manifests in a different way. It's as though your intent-focused intention changes something in the physical world. And usually, I think of this in terms, it changes it in a probabilistic way. The law of attraction is not 100%. It changes the probability of things rather than the thing itself. But ultimately, the effect can be the same.
So in your view, when people want to utilize this law of attraction, you know, there's all kinds of books out there, there's movies now. When they want to utilize it, is it like a skill that you think they can learn? Or is it just that some people are gifted in this whatever ability that they have to to change their reality by observing it, by whatever's going on inside the brain or their consciousness.
Some people are more talented than others.
Yeah.
Which should not be surprising, because otherwise it wouldn't be fun to watch sports, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So why there's talent, we're just on the, I think, the cusp of being able to understand in this domain why people have some talents and other people don't. And even in a laboratory, when you do experiments involving physical target systems, you're asking somebody to tightly focus their intention or attention on some physical system, and you're measuring how that system changes when it's being, when attention is drawn at it versus away, which is typically how you do these experiments. Many people show effects. They're usually really small, tiny, tiny little effects. Some people are much, much better at it than others. And as I said, we're maybe finding certain personality differences, some maybe genetic differences between people that account for their ability to hold the intention longer. Underneath it all is probably the strongest modulator is motivation. So if you're highly motivated to do something, that will focus your attention in a way that something like a silly laboratory experiment will not. It's very difficult in a lab environment to create the kind of motivation that you see in the real world, because usually it's not ethical to do that. But you can still see it, even with motivation that's simply somebody's asking you to do something. That's a motivation. It's not very strong. So you can say, okay, I'll give you $1,000 if you can do this. You know, focus your attention. That will help a little bit. But it turns out to be really difficult to focus your attention on anything for more than a couple of seconds. So that's why these effects tend not to be that strong. In the real world, where you have extremely high motivation to do something, you can focus a lot better.
And isn't there like an experiment a prize for someone that can prove that they have quote unquote psychic abilities, or like, isn't there a famous prize out there for like $1 million for anyone that can prove that?
Yeah. For many years, it was a prize given by a magician who has passed away, that if you can demonstrate a psychic effect, any psychic effect, under well-controlled conditions, that you would get the prize. And so a big deal was made of the fact that nobody ever won the prize. But what they don't tell you is that the conditions under which you had to demonstrate it were such that it's beyond what people can do. Really? No wonder nobody won it. So, I mean, you look back at this now and you see that was essentially a kind of, not exactly a scam, but a way of setting up an unwinnable prize to prove a point.
Yeah.
So in a sense, the point is that, well, first of all, some people are delusional and they don't have psychic abilities. But more likely is that these abilities for most people, even ones who are talented, are not really under very good control. And so you have to do probabilistic tests. Say, we're not going to do this once. We're going to do this 1,000 times over a period of months with the same person again and again and again, and under conditions where you don't have a phalanx of skeptics jeering at you all the time, because that'll destroy the ability to do it. Just like, you know, if you get somebody who can do someone who's not a professional poet, but occasionally will come up with a pretty good poem. So now you sit them down and now there's a panel of judges in front of them snickering at you saying, okay, do it. Well, now do it. You're not doing it yet. Can you never do it? We don't believe you. You don't win the prize. And so under those conditions, it's not too surprising that these prizes are difficult to win, because that's not how the way the phenomenon works.
Yeah. Even, you know, especially scientifically, like you mentioned before, if we're talking about the brain operating on a quantum level, there's so many different things that are probably happening in that brain. And under stress, I mean, we just know stress literally kills it. You know, under stress, there's all kinds of chemicals that are released physiologically that shut down growth, that shut down the body's ability to function optimally. So, and even in that situation, it could literally be that simple. If they're under stress like that, the part of their brain that does do this super normal thing is not going to function properly.
Yeah, we know it is from laboratory tests that if you are anxious about performing, it's not even just laboratory, but like any context, if you're anxious about doing some kind of performance, your ability to do it goes way, way down.
Yeah.
Which is one of the reasons why it's so astonishing when watching something like a football game that a really good quarterback who's making $20 to $40 million a year is doing that, is able to get that kind of money because they're under enormous stress and they're still able to perform well.
Yeah.
That's extremely unusual. That's why they get so much money. And the same could be said for people at the level of the Olympics.
Yeah.
Right? You're performing against the best other people in the world, enormous amounts of stress, and the fact that they can do it at all is just really astonishing. That's why it's fun to watch.
Yeah, it's incredible. Even, you know, situations like the Super Bowl or a heavyweight title fight where there's millions and millions of people watching and it's just all the pressure's on these guys and they perform day after day. A lot of these guys actually go to psychologists, to sports psychologists to get over that. You yeah. even use techniques like hypnotism to train their brain and a subconscious mind to be able to function and perform at their best under that intense pressure, which
and,
is another subject too.
And 20 to 40 years of 8 to 10 hours a day practice.
Yeah.
Right. So you don't have to consciously think about what you're doing anymore. It's like your body takes over.
Yeah.
So that's true in practically any kind of performance skill. Even it's something that's intellectual like chess.
Yeah.
Right. I can play really, really good against a chess computer. You put another human over there and they will psych me out in an instant and I can't do anything.
Nice. Yeah. I love chess too. It's a great game. What are some of the most fascinating or incredible things that you've seen from the research that you've done personally? Like when you bring these different types of people into the lab, when you study them, when you do these tests, what are some of the things that would most shock some of the people, or at least most interest some of the people that you're talking to about when you mention this subject, when they ask you who are some of the more incredible, interesting people that you brought into the laboratory
proven.
It's a habit.
Yeah.
But have shown you, have demonstrated the evidence of their abilities. What are some of the most interesting ones?
Well, I have seen, I'll mention something about this, but for me, the thing that is most shocking about all of this is that even relatively normal people, like people who don't make special claims, maybe they're a meditator, maybe they have had experiences, they can get good results in a laboratory context where we know that that what happened, we're able to track it very closely. So the effect may not be outstandingly strong, but it's statistically significant. You know, it's not chance. And they can do it on demand. So there's two things there. One is the phenomena are real. They're not chance. And more importantly, they can do it when we ask them to do it in the form in which we want them to do it. So I mean, this is what gets me excited, because it means that we're not dealing with the one in a billion person. We're dealing with ordinary people who are able to do something that, from the perspective of the rest of science, it's not even clear that this is a real phenomenon. So from a scientific perspective, any of this stuff being real is already shocking. And I've been doing this for a long time, and I'm still kind of shocked when I see a good result. But I would say that the experiences that I've had with expert remote viewers, because I worked on the government program years ago. So that program was kind of interested in the science behind it, like how do we choose people who are better? How do we make it better? But they were primarily focused on practical use. We're doing psychic espionage. And so a selection process was done, and they found some people in the Army and elsewhere who were really, really good at these kinds of things. So I remember the first time I finally got all the clearances and was able to get the briefing for why this project was working and what had been found and so on. And I saw at the time as highly classified, but now most of it is known. Example after example of operational missions where somebody was asked, there's a place in the world, tell me about it. I mean, almost literally like that. There's this thing that we're interested in, tell me about it. And then they would start drawing sketches and saying stuff that turned out to be almost photographically true.
Wow.
And I remember thinking of like, holy crap, is this really possible? Well, I'm being told in a way where at that time, about 100 people in the world were aware that the project was actually happening. And it was very valuable as a result, because it meant that it's basically a secret project and it was giving valuable information. And I was seeing it. So up to that point, there were some rumors that the government was doing something like this, but nobody knew for sure. Well, now I knew it for sure. And I got to meet those people. And the interesting thing about it was that you would never, ever have guessed that these people who look like everybody else and behave like everybody else had that particular talent. And so the stereotype of Madame Zodiac and all of that, that's not the way it works. These are people who you would not be able to tell by their behavior, by their profession, or by the way they look or anything else, that they had this particular talent. So I decided back then, that was 1985, that if it was possible to work as a scientist doing this kind of research to figure out how are these people different and how are they able to do what they're doing, that's how I wanted to spend my time. So I've been lucky and figured out a way of doing that.
Do you think the Army, or I've heard actually, and I think it was the 60s, the CIA did a bunch of tests on, again, psychic abilities or, you know, paranormal abilities, supernormal abilities. I think they tested a bunch of people, like you mentioned, and especially for wartime efforts, to use them basically as a tool to figure out what the enemy's up to. Do you think that the CIA, I guess in particular, or maybe in the military in general, they utilize these people even today for such cases?
Well, I would say that there's two elements of that question. One is there a program? Is there any systematic program happening that is continuing what was done? I don't know. If there is, it's classified, and I'm not in that world anymore, so I don't know. My response to it, though, is I hope so, because it works. It doesn't work 100%, but no intelligence gathering works 100%. That's why you have intelligence analysts. They take information from lots of different sources and try to create a coherent picture out of it. And that was true even in this case. So the program I was on was active from 1972 to 1995. And with pretty much the same cadre of people, a dozen or two people who were quite good, they weren't 100%. They got information sometimes that would blow your socks off. A lot of times they were wrong. So it was up to the analyst to say, well, we're interested in this thing. Tell me about it. They would get information. They would take all of the other forms of information that they could get around the world and try to put it together into a picture. And we know that it was successful because some of the agencies came back again and again and again, 50 to 100 times, asking for more information. So one of the areas that was most successful were joint task force, which involved typically the Navy and the Coast Guard and a bunch of other people who were doing drug interdiction. So they knew that the way that drugs are coming into the country was a small boat would land somewhere in Florida or off the coast of wherever. And it was very difficult to spot because they were coming in under darkness and changing their behavior and all that. But they really wanted to find them. So they would use every trick in the book, including the psychics, to say, well, you know, where do you think this guy's coming in? And of course, they wouldn't tell them that they're doing drug interdiction. They're just saying, tell me about this thing I want to know about. They would get information. It would match. And in enough cases, the information that they gave was consistent enough that it was useful in actually doing these interdictions. And so the Joint Task Force came back something like 150 times. So these are 150 different missions where they found that the information was useful.
Wow. Yeah, that's also reminds me too of if there's like a missing persons case and they're trying to locate the body. The detectives have in the past used, or like state police detectives, FBI have used these types of people to help find the missing person. And I don't know how many times they've used it, but I know for sure that it's happened a number of times documented where this person with the gift was able to help locate the body.
Or locate the criminal.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, yeah. So in murder cases. Yeah. So in the current case happening now at the University of Idaho, there are four students that were killed.
Oh yeah.
So, a few people I know are quite good at this, and they gave me information and I passed it along up the chain. And whether it's used and how it's used, I have no idea because I'm not involved in that. But I'm, as a conduit, can pass it along to people who will get it to the investigators.
Wow.
That's incredible. And then a few cases that I've dealt with, I know that the information ultimately did turn out to be right.
That's awesome.
So, yeah. That's so but cool. See, that's quite different. It's not a program. I think it would be more effective as a program. You know, that's like if law enforcement really wants to know something, they would go to this group somewhere. Probably they would be secret because you don't want to be known for being able to do that because you become a target. But nevertheless, it would be known to law enforcement and then they would go and be able to get information. And they have lots of information from other sources. And again, it would be up to an analyst to figure out what to do with it.
Yeah.
So my guess is it would be similar to what the Army was finding, that sometimes it was spectacularly on target and other times it wasn't. And of course, the curious thing is that the psychics don't know. They can't tell if it's hot or not, partially because it's very difficult to localize these effects in time. So they could be off by years. They could be off by location-wise, by miles. But fortunately, it works often enough that sometimes it does provide useful information.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that too, because time does seem to be something that really only exists on this planet as far as our perception of it. And from my experience working with or talking to different people with this ability, they all seem to say that time is very relative and individually based on our perception of it. Whereas like in this supernatural or supernormal world, it seems to not really, like even in the afterlife, for instance, when people like pass over and, you know, they have connections with mediums back on Earth, they all kind of say the same thing. They all describe the same type of phenomena that's going on after they pass away, for one. And then for two, they all seem to talk about the fact that time isn't real and that we only think that it's real because of our experience here and, you know, the way that we have clocks and things like that make it seem so real. But in reality, or in, you know, the real, I guess, way the universe works, it's not actually something that we can comprehend.
Yeah, there is no universal clock.
Yeah.
I mean, atomic clocks now are so accurate that if you take two clocks, two of these atomic clocks, and you synchronize them so they start out in the same time, they will maintain the same time for like a century. They are so tight with each other. So now you take one clock, and then you get a sheet of paper and you put the other clock on top of the sheet of paper. The clock on the bottom will run slower than the one on the piece of paper. Why? Because it's closer to the Earth. And so the gravity, as Einstein showed, gravity and time are closely related. So if there's more gravity, time moves slower. And you can see that now with these clocks, even at the distance of a fraction of a millimeter apart. So if you put them a foot apart, 10 feet apart, so it's much easier to see. But nevertheless, it's really astonishing that you can show relativistic effects as small a distance as a sheet of paper.
Wow.
Which, among other things, means that your feet are younger than your head because your feet are closer to the Earth, usually.
That's fascinating. All right. So I know we do have to wrap it up in a few moments. But I kind of want to ask you sort of a rapid sequence of questions where I just want your quick thought on it, like your opinion on it based on your experience and the evidence that has been presented to you over, you know, four decades, whether you think that it there's something to it or whether it's, you know, just a claim. Like, for instance, I guess we can just jump right into it and go from there. But something that from your experience that you think that there's something there or something from your experience that you can't tell one way or the other. In other words, it's probably not because you've seen the gambit of things in all your research. At least
you're
from
asking,
what
you're
I,
asking
from what
hot
I would say.
Or not.
Yeah, exactly. So I guess the first one, because we were just kind of talking about that as well, but mediums, psychics, people that can predict the future, people that can, I guess they're two different things, but also somewhat related, but psychics and mediums, people that can predict the future, people that can connect with those who have crossed over. In your experience, is it hot or not?
You're talking about mediums in particular?
Yeah.
Mediums who specialize in contacting the dead can get accurate information about departed people. It is not clear where they get the information from. So there may be dead people that they're communicating with, or maybe they're telepathic, or maybe they're clairvoyant or something. That is not resolved to my satisfaction.
Okay. So there for sure, but the mechanism of how they're doing it could vary or is unknown, but could certainly vary. It could be a number of ways.
It could be a number of ways, but more importantly, it is not clear that there are spirits. I mean, their experience is that they're talking to somebody who's departed. There are other interpretations, though, that would give exactly the same result. And that's then, I mean, so we can tell in a laboratory test that they're getting accurate information, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the information is coming from what they say it's coming from.
Huh. Now that's very interesting. So I guess this is a little more down the list, but I guess I'll just jump right into this one as well. Your take on ghosts or spirits. What, like, is that something that you've been able to find any information on?
Well, it's similar to the question about mediums. Are there actually departed spirits that are still here in some way, manifest in some way? For me, the jury is out. I don't know what the answer is because, among other things, it's not only difficult, it may at this point be impossible, given the methods that we use, to be able to actually bring that into the laboratory and get the same kind of in principle answers that we get about psychic effects. So we don't know how to bring a ghost into the lab. We don't know how to evoke such things into the lab under conditions where we can exclude ordinary explanations. We just don't know how to do that.
Have you ever tried to go to quote unquote haunted houses or places that have had these, anecdotes of having spirits and ghosts in there?
Yes, I've done some field research. I would say one of the reasons I don't do it anymore is because the ratio of seeing something interesting versus not interesting is 1,000 to 1. So you'll spend 1,000 hours doing field research to find an hour where something might or might not have happened.
Wow.
And when you start then looking at those strange things that happen, can you actually figure out what happened? Like and the answer is no, because in the vast majority of cases, it's spontaneous. You know, you have a weird feeling, so something happened, and you there's no way of figuring it out. And so that's why I don't do that anymore. So I'm convinced that people will go out into the real world and have all kinds of weird experiences, but we are very capable of generating weird experiences. So there may be nothing objectively there. It could be all completely subjective, which is fine. You know, I have other colleagues who have done much more haunting type research than I have, and they have very, very strange stories that something weird is going on. I'm not very satisfied with those kinds of stories, even though I don't doubt what my colleagues are telling me, mainly because they're so difficult to nail down. So I like to go into the laboratory and even work on very simplistic kinds of tests because you can get better and better confidence about whether the thing is real. That still doesn't say we're going to explain why it is real, but we know that it is, as opposed to studying weird things that are spontaneous, which are very exciting, except that, like, at the end of the day, you're wondering, well, what was that thing? you know, it's a blob of light on a photograph or something. You know, it's just very difficult to be able to gain confidence that this is what it looks like. You know, there's lots of reasons why a blob of light can show up and why something funny can show up on a recorder, those kinds of things. So people will interpret it in terms of, we went to the haunted place, it must be a ghost. Well, not necessarily. There's lots of things, lots of strange things. I, one example, people take a picture and see orbs in the picture and then attribute all kinds of things to the orbs. In most cases, the orbs are dust. They don't think of it as dust, but it is dust. And an easy way to demonstrate that is, if there's a real thing out there, which is the interpretation that it's a thing out there, take a stereo camera, start taking pictures with that, and see how often the orbs are out there using a 3D. And the answer is, to my knowledge, never. It's something very close to one of the lenses, but it's not something out there, because if it was, you'd be able to look through the stereo picture and see, you'd be able to calculate where it was. Well, they're not out there. I'd prefer that they were out there, because it would make things much more interesting. Yeah. But friends of mine who were completely convinced that they were taking pictures of orbs, I convinced them, make a system that takes stereo digital pictures using the cameras that you're using. And they come back and say, no, it's just in one of the images, it's not in the other one. So that means it's dust in front of the lens or an insect or something.
See that? All right. I wanted to go rapid with this, but probably 6 months ago, and I kind of have the same type of, at least I think I do, the same type of outlook on this as you do, which is, I'll see something, and you know, I'm actually kind of a skeptical person by nature, but I'm also a very curious person and a very open-minded person. So if I see enough evidence, then I'll start to believe that something's true. But I also won't just jump to conclusions. I have actually a couple different, and this is another one I was going to bring up, but UFO videos where I see something in, you know, the sky. I don't know what it is. I'll take my camera out. I have two of those that I think are pretty good, pretty interesting, at least. I don't know what it is. It could be anything, but it's very interesting to, you know, it's fun to guess at it too. I also have another video where I have an orb video. It was like a nanny cam that was downstairs at my sister's house. We were taking turns watching my grandmother when she was really sick. We kind of keeping an eye on her. And there's this video where there's a bunch of, it happens out of nowhere kind of too. There's these like orb things start popping into the video. Mm-hmm. And then in one, like they're kind of flying around for a few minutes and then they kind of go away. And then there's this one that comes from like the back, which is probably 15 to 20 feet back window. And it comes like flying towards the camera. And it's almost like it fly, like it's like moving. So the other ones are kind of like all floating around, and this one comes out of nowhere and it flies right into the camera over the course of like, you know, a second and a half. Super interesting. Again, I don't know what the hell. It could be anything, could be nothing, could be dust. But when I looked at it, I was like, this is very interesting. And I showed a couple of friends. Some family members had the same reaction. You know, this is dust, it's nothing. Others were on the other side where, you know, this is something. I don't know what it is, but it looks very interesting. So when I see things like that, it certainly piques my curiosity, and I always have to try to at least make a note of like what's happening. And there's been some other things that I've seen over the years too, but I would love to send you that video if you are interested in ever looking at it, just to see what Sure. you think of it and Yeah. and your take, because the things that are floating around are kind of one thing, but the one that kind of flies, it almost like it has an intelligence to it. It definitely makes you question what's going on in that video.
That's good. I mean, anything that stimulates the curiosity is the way to go, right? I mean, it's thrilling. My approach to those kinds of things is to figure out if this was a spirit or something, some intelligent blob of light, how would we test that?
Yeah.
And if sometimes we don't know how to test it, so it remains a mystery. Which is fine. I prefer to solve the mysteries.
Yeah.
And so we say, well, okay, well, the easiest way to do that is stereo images. Because then you'll find out very quickly, was it really something coming at the camera like that? Something flying, maybe an insect or something. But if it was, you would know it immediately. Because you would see it in both images. You'd see it moving and, you know, you'd figure it out. So there's lots of other ways of doing that too. Different kinds of sensors that you could have to like instrument an entire room. Like something is haunted and people see something there, well, instrument the heck out of it. And then it doesn't matter if it's spontaneous because you're recording all the time. So, I mean, there are ways of doing this and you're not going to get funding to do it, but if it's a hobby, well, why not? It's fun.
It is fun. It's very interesting. On that note as well, your experience with exorcisms, I know they've been documenting this in the Catholic Church for hundreds of years, actually. There seems to be a good amount of evidence that there's something there as well, but what's your take on that?
I have no idea.
You haven't looked at that one?
I've heard stories from people who are apparently credible who say that weird things happen. Again, it's spontaneous, typically. And I tend to avoid spontaneous things. So if we can get an exorcism in the lab, it would have to be pretty darn strange to think that it was something other than the range of ways that people can behave, right? If somebody is psychotic, for example, and you didn't know about psychosis, you can say, well, they're possessed. Well, maybe, but if somebody's off the rocker, they can behave in pretty strange ways. That doesn't require the idea that they're possessed by something. In other cultures, there is no psychosis. It is only possession. So culture shapes a lot of how we interpret that if things are happening. So it's not surprising that in Catholicism, that you can be possessed, in which case a priest who does exorcisms, one would hope, also knows about the psychiatric ways of thinking about it. But nevertheless, they would say if this person is profoundly religious, they may respond best to the idea that they're possessed by something. So you do a ritual to pull that out, and maybe that'll actually make them better. Because their belief now is that, oh, it wasn't me, it was the thing inside me, and they took it out, and now I'm better.
Yeah, which actually is another phenomenon as well, which is the placebo effect, right?
Sure.
I mean, that's another one. And that's science right there. They can't explain exactly how that works, but that's why they do the double-blind placebo-controlled studies to prove, to negate the fact that that phenomena actually is working all the time, right?
It's very powerful.
Yeah.
Yep.
Another one is UFOs. Your thoughts on that? Is the same type of thing here where you can't bring it into the lab, or do you actually believe there's something more there?
I'm pretty well convinced that there is something more going on. I have no idea what it is. I know a number of people who are serious scientists who have investigated for a long time. I think it's quite clear that whatever's going on is not a modern phenomenon. It's been around for a very long time. Manifests in a variety of different ways. How to interpret it, I have no idea. And I'm also pretty well convinced that nobody else has a very good idea either. At least for those who are studying it seriously, they don't know. They don't know what it is. It's not standing still long enough to chat with the extraterrestrials or whatever they happen to be to tell us. And if it is truly alien, ET type, the likelihood that we'd be able to understand it, given our normal worldview, is very, very small. I mean, like maybe we can't understand it.
Yeah. I mean, we've only really had like real technology for the last like 100 years, computer, what, 80, 60 years now, maybe? Like,
yeah.
I mean, basic computers, 60 years. Yeah. You have a civilization that was even 1,000 years and more advanced a million years more advanced. I mean, they would just be light years ahead of us in terms of their physics and their understanding of the universe.
Yeah. I mean, show an iPhone to Benjamin Franklin, who was one of the smartest people of his time.
Yeah.
He would have no idea even how to begin to understand it.
Yeah.
Even today, how many people can you show an iPhone to and say, well, how does this work? Most people have no idea how it works. We accept it because it works. So, at this point, I would imagine that there are very few people, individuals, who now know how all elements of it work. It's just too complicated. So you're right. Get a technology 1,000 years ahead of us. Even the ETs don't know how it works anymore. Because, who knows how long it took, how many people and different expertise it took to make the thing. The world, the more you know about the way reality is, the more complex it gets, not the simpler. So,
Fascinating.
It doesn't bother me either, right? I mean, I'm surrounded by things that I don't know how to explain, and so I'm comfortable with ambiguity, and you kind of have to be when you're working at the edge of the known, because most of the time you have no idea what's going on.
Yeah, you definitely have to be, man. Otherwise, your mind will just spin all day long. I mean, you got to kind of get grounded, right? All right, just a couple quick ones, and then we're going to wrap it up. Past lives, do you have any evidence on that? Or, have you seen people that have come into the lab and talked about that? Have they had similar stories, anything related to that?
Well, I'm most familiar with reincarnation cases. I haven't studied it myself, but I have colleagues who have. And the stories are pretty compelling in some cases, that especially young children who know things they shouldn't be able to know.
Yeah, where does that come from? Speak a different language from out of nowhere, right?
Yeah, that's pretty unusual. But knowing names and things that happen to people that their family doesn't know, and they have no idea where this came from, that's strange. So whether that is truly meaning a past life, maybe. Well, if you're Tibetan, then it would be taken for granted. Of course there's a past life. So again, there's a lot of cultural ways of interpreting these kinds of phenomena. One thing we kind of know is that kids around age 3 or 4 are way more psychic than adults, because they haven't learned yet that you're not supposed to have these things. So it's possible that these most compelling stories are kids generally 3, 4 years old who are telling things that they shouldn't be able to know. Well, maybe they're clairvoyant. Maybe they're precognitive. Maybe they're telepathic or something like that. And they can't express it in those terms because they don't even know that those things are real, or they don't know that they exist. They don't know anything yet. So they're able to express things that turn out to be true, which in an adult, we'd say, oh, he's a good psychic. But the kids generally will grow up. In most cases, they will either lose or forget that they have these abilities. And then at some point, they're gone. I mean, they don't have the ability anymore. But that's typical of children, especially these younger children who, like, just getting to the point where they're ambulatory and have language. And then their reality is very different than even a teenager, very, very different than an adult. So in some respects, people who are adults who have these abilities have elements of these young kids in them that they never grew up, like Peter Pan or something.
That's interesting. That's actually fascinating. All right, two more. Telekinesis, moving things with your mind. Have you seen any evidence for that?
For moving macroscopic objects, there are a few cases in the literature that seem to be credible. Extremely rare. So when I do studies involving mind-matter interaction, we're talking about mentally manipulating, apparently, probabilistic events. That's generally what we see. So I'm pretty well convinced that that is a real thing, that we can somehow, mind can manipulate, not matter per se, but probabilistic events. So back in the old classical physics day, that what I just said doesn't make any sense. Now we're in the quantum world. The quantum world is all about probabilities. So it kind of yet is another opening to the idea that mind somehow interacts with matter in a probabilistic way. So you can do things. You can do all kinds of things if you can manipulate probabilities, even to a small degree. That does seem to be a real phenomenon. But large-scale effects like levitation and moving things like we see in movies, so rare to be like 1 in a billion people can sometimes do it.
But you think that people haven't historically, there have been a couple of people historically that have been able to do such things?
Yeah. So you look in history for people where there's a lot of evidence, usually almost in all cases, actually observable evidence, there may be 5, 6 people who had that kind of, but now you look back at 100 billion people who have been alive at some point. Well, there you go. There's like 1 in 10 billion people who have this ability. And they don't seem to want to go into the laboratory. So, we have no response to that. And say, yeah, historically, and maybe even contemporarily, there are some people who can do pretty amazing things, but they have no interest in doing it for for science. So we don't know.
Yeah. Okay. Last one is clairvoyance, in particular, predicting the future. Have you been able to study that?
Recognition, presentiment. Yeah.
Okay. So that's all related to it. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's different than so-called fortune telling, but it in principle, it really isn't. The underlying question is, can you perceive something in the future that is unpredictable, you can't anticipate and you can't infer? The answer is yes.
Have you seen people though have been able to actually predict like events in like real time? Like someone says like next week this is going to happen, or like in a month this is going to happen. Like some of the more famous psychics per se that would be able to do that consistently. Have you come across that?
Well, consistently, I'm not sure about, but are there cases where remote viewers in particular can predict things at least 9 months in advance that were very unpredictable? And the answer is yes. So it can happen. Doesn't seem to happen that often, but yeah, it somehow we can gain information about what's going to happen.
Wow. That's some of the...
In the lab, we're generally dealing with matters of less than a minute, because otherwise, you know, the experiment would go on forever. For remote viewing, you can do experiments going out months, and they seem to work just as well as they do a matter of minutes. So, yeah, it's a real phenomenon. It's like all of these effects, they're probabilistic in the sense that even people who believe that they're 100% psychic, they can always predictably do something. That is so rare that it is virtually never seen under laboratory conditions. I'm not saying it's impossible. I'm just saying it is so rare that from a scientific perspective, we can't confirm that that's true or not. But we do know it exists at a probabilistic level that is absolutely not due to chance. And it's not being made up. It's a real phenomenon. It's not like the movies. On the other hand, what is like the movies? Even documentaries, even so-called reality TV isn't real. So, you know, we take those stories with a grain of salt and say, well, okay, there's something going on. But, you know, be careful about accepting stories on face value.
Okay. Just a kind of a lighthearted question now. Of all these topics, of all the things you've studied maybe, or just things that you've kind of not even brought into the lab, but just checked into here and there occasionally, like we all do when we want to go down a YouTube rabbit hole, what's one of the most interesting things that you like to just kind of check out or research on your own?
Well, for many years, I've had friends tell me about spoon bending. And I thought that was ridiculous, because I have one around here somewhere. I don't know what I did with it. I used to have it right here. Oh, here it is. Yeah. So I had a friend who said that he went to a so-called spoon bending party where they do this sort of thing. And what he's describing that people can do, like a lot of people can bend the neck of a fork or bend the neck of a spoon. That's not that difficult. You can do that with force, even not even realizing how much force you're using, because the neck is small, and it's not that easy to, it's not difficult to bend. So I said, well, yeah, okay, so you did this, but, you know, maybe you just dissociated for a moment and you didn't know your own strength. What would I be much more interested in if you could bend the bowl of a spoon in half? Because the shell shape of a bowl is stamped in such a way that it really resists getting bent in half, especially a large soup spoon. So I once got one and measured with a torque wrench, how much torque does it actually take to do that? And it's way beyond the average person, and especially way beyond what I can do. I cannot do that. I mean, I would seriously injure myself even trying. So nevertheless, I went to one of these parties and wanted to sit in front of somebody who claimed that they could bend the bowl of a spoon by any means. So there was a woman I knew who claimed to have done that. So I sat in front of her and watched her do it. And it turned, and so I got the same kind of spoon, and I was kind of mimicking what she was doing, hoping she would do it, and she didn't, but I did. So and this is that spoon. So it's a big, heavy soup spoon, and I bent the bowl in half. And I know, because I got the same kind of spoon, how much force it takes to do that. I also know that when you do that, it doesn't remain shiny. It actually starts cracking when you do that, if you do it by force. So I did that. So before I did this, I was very skeptical that this was even possible. After doing it, I know that I did it because they still have this stupid thing. So this, you could think of this, and this is a macroscopic psychokinetic effect, right? Something happened. It's a permanent object. It did change. I have no idea how that happened. What I do know is that after doing it, I was flying back home, and they had another spoon like this, and I was kind of looking at this one, and I was trying to mimic, you know, what was my mental state when I made this happen? And in the process of doing that, I suddenly got very frightened because I didn't know how I did this. And now I'm inside a big hunk of metal, which is going 500 miles an hour up in the air. And I didn't accidentally want to do this to the wings of the airplane. And so I put it down and said, okay, I'm not going to do that anymore. Now, once I'm back home, you know, I've tried again. I've never been able to do it again. So there's some peculiar state of mind or something that's necessary to be able to get into that state. I did have the presence of mind when this happened to immediately look at my fingers to see, you know, because if you start pressing this really hard, you'll see an indentation.
Yeah.
No indentation. It felt just like people have described. It feels like putty. It momentarily got soft, bent it over, hardened up. There it is. I put this in boiling water to see if it's like, you know, memory metal or something. It isn't. It just stays that way. So, yeah. So strange things happen. We don't have explanations for it. I certainly don't.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
I think you got to bring that one into the lab and try to figure that out, though.
We've had people willing to fund us to do that. And we haven't really pursued it, though, because to do it right would require specially instrumented pieces of metal. Probably not a spoon, something else, either a bar or something.
Yeah.
It would be possible to do, and there have been people back in the 60s and 70s who are trying to figure it out. And there are actually a number of interesting articles and books written about this, and they were never able to figure it out either. So we have to figure then, we know there are things we can study in the laboratory that work pretty well. This one's a major mystery. Figuring it out would be quite interesting, but it could take it could take 40 years with instruments that we don't even have yet to know why it happened. So we figure out, you know, if we're thinking about how difficult it is to raise funding to do this kind of research, do we want to deflect it into something that is still a major mystery, even though finding out the answer would be kind of interesting? Well, no. When you do that equation, it's better to keep working on what we can do in the laboratory rather than launching off into something that's still a gigantic mystery.
Yeah. Dean, it's been an awesome interview, man. I really do appreciate your time. What's the last send-off takeaway message you'd like to leave the Elite Man audience, and then a place our listeners can check out your work, your book, what you're up to right now?
I would say, since this is about the Elite Man, how many of the really talented people do I know were men versus women? I would say it's about 50-50. That the stereotype is that women are more intuitive, are able to have access to this stuff more easily. And many of the mediums that we've worked with have been women. But when it comes to remote viewing, to psychokinetic effects and that sort of thing, it's 50-50. Wow. So it doesn't seem to have any particular gender bias in one direction or the other for this.
Very interesting.
Yeah. And, you know, like we see in sports, that the people who can excel that these kinds of phenomena are very similar, and that they have incredibly tight focus. They can focus to a degree that is very unusual. Sometimes they're meditators, but they don't need to be. Some people are just naturally able to have incredibly tight focus on things, and that seems to allow them to do things that an average person can't do. So maybe that's the Elite Man.
Yeah, being able to dial in on that for sure.
Yeah.
What's the website, the place our listeners can check out your work?
Well, deanraden.com. So I list events that I do there and information about my books and stuff. And I have most of my articles, most of my publications are available. And also I put a library of other sources and articles. And I work at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, which is noetic.org. And I'm also co-founder and chairman of a genetic engineering company, which has nothing to do with psychic phenomena, except that it's related to our looking for a genetic component for this kind of talent. So that's a whole other story, which we don't have time to go into, but I have my fingers and feet in lots of different things.
Happening. Yeah, that's awesome. Maybe we'll have to get you back on the podcast one day and dive into some of that stuff. But Dean, thanks so much, man, for coming on. I really do appreciate your time. And I know our guys are going to love this one. It's so fascinating. So take care and I'll talk to you soon.
Great. Bye.
All right, guys. I hope you enjoyed that episode. But before you go, there's one last thing I'd like you to do. And that's this. Subscribe to our podcast right now if you haven't already. By subscribing to the podcast, you get every single episode the minute they're released. Get all of our Elite Man podcast episodes and all of our world-class advice absolutely free. Subscribe now if you haven't already and become an Elite Man today. And yes, if you do love the podcast, leave us an amazing review. We really do appreciate it.